Can you explain to me the group?
The new group.
The new group.
Yes.
Who was on that board?
Okay. Well, then Henry said that he needed an executive on the board, and he said he thought I was the guy, the first guy. I think I was the only executive. We set off, Henry set off. Brian left because the mill now was closed and he had no interest, and he went off to, can't remember, lovely guy. And Henry set off. When I say Henry, he involved me in literally every step he involved me. I mean, we got on extremely well. And we started to look around for acquisitions. Now, nothing like Smurfit in the sense of nothing is dynamic, but we wanted to put on bits. So I had good connections in the industry generally and in England kind of thing. You know, I knew people from going to conferences or going here and there. So I spotted this place called A.P. Burt. Now, my first approach to them was that I wanted to get out of paper bag. Now that the mill wasn't there, I wanted out of paper bags altogether. There's no money in it. But this guy, again, you see the size. He had 40 machines. I had 12. You can't compete in scale with that kind of thing. So I went over to see David Baker, and he said, yeah, I'll supply you whatever you want. Doesn't matter what you want. I have loads of machines here. And the second time I went back to see him, he said to me, I don't think you're over here to buy paper bags at all, Tom. I said, well, and what do you think I'm here for? He says, I think you're here to take us over.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'm not, but I will go back to my boss, the group managing director, and I'll talk to him. So, God, Henry was his ears.
I know, just
up.
Felt
perfect.
That this would be a good
Well, it was merger. The first one. It was the first one. So we could test ourselves out.
Test the tide.
Yeah, the tide. So we took that over. They were in a place called Porter's Head in outside Bristol. And we integrated that. And Henry gave me responsibility for making sure the whole thing got integrated. And it did. And they were very efficient. It went very well. And then we set off. I can't remember what the next one was, but I used to travel all over England with him to various places, you know, and I went to the States with him a couple of times. But anyway, time was going on. I was still managing director of Bailey Gibson and a director of Clondalkin, and Clondalkin expanded and became very profitable, quite profitable, and did very well. It was on the stock market and all the rest of it. And is it this minute? I haven't got access to the figures. At this minute, I think it's turning over a billion and making quite good money. And the a fellow that I brought in called Norbert McDermott from Oldcastle, County Meath, passionate about Gaelic football, has just retired. He was my financial controller. He was first place in the MBA. He eventually became the managing director of the group, and he's just retired, just wrote to me, and I hope to see him in Kells on the last Saturday of July.
All right, yes.
Now it's owned by a big one of those American investment companies now, the whole group. It's not quoted on the stock exchange anymore. It's a private company.
The fate of the mills then was that it was closed down, but the group unions...
You see, you're talking about two different eras. In 1938, I think it started, and you can imagine 1938, what was going on in Europe. Like, nobody in it, in Ireland.
Yeah.
So, like, the whole place was protected. It was totally dominated by the church and the politicians. Like, all the institutions completely controlled the country. So, Clondalkin was set up with all these guys putting up money to get it started, and the government was interested in it, and Devil Era would have been interested in it, and it got going. And I'd say it was fine, like until competition came in. And when competition came in, it had no chance. It had no chance, like no chance against the Scandinavians. The Scandinavians took, cut down the trees here, made pulp here, and made the paper there.
Right.
So Clondalkin had to buy that pulp.
Okay.
And try. No chance. Absolutely no chance.
Okay, so the companies that would survive are your
packaging
company, packaging.
Yeah, we became a packaging group.
Yeah, and so you were in, were you still in competition against?
Oh, all the time.
Like
Oh yeah. Well, I eventually ended up being responsible for CB Packaging. CB Packaging made sacks. Now the sacks, I'm sure you people in Kerry will buy their sacks. They were cement sacks. The biggest contract was with Cement Roadstone. Cement sacks, provender sacks, you understand the word provender?
I do, yes.
Potato sacks. We set up a plant to do the fertilizer, you know, the big, huge things you get in the garden centres.
Yes.
Fertilizer sacks, and a very profitable company.
Okay.
That was CEB. That was Clondalkin Bishop. Now, that bishop was Ken Bishop.
Yes.
He lived on the Merrion Road, and they had gone into Sachs way back, and they had merged. It was a 50-50 partnership with them,
yeah.
And Henry bought him out. Extraordinary thing. At a dinner in the recent past, I met a fellow, Clara. There's a sack company in Clara, which it's... I don't think it's...
Good
still,
buddies.
Yeah, good yes. buddies. Yeah. Good. Now, I met the guy... at a dinner. He's very old, but he's still actually, I don't think he's making any sacks here now. I think he's importing them. But they were making them up quite recently, but they were jute sacks. That's another
yeah.
type of sack,
yes.
a different kind of thing. So there was CB. Then there was Swiftbrook. Henry made me responsible for Swiftbrook very early, but it had stopped making paper. We were flogging Clondalkin's paper, but then Clondalkin closed, so we had to get another source. So we got our source in Scotland, a lovely mill near St. Andrews, the
yes.
Scotland place. And they were. Nobody knew Morris, of course, for a good while. The Swiftbrook bond was actually been made in Scotland. It was supposed to be made here, but like nobody cares once the sheet is good, you know. So that was very, very profitable paper merchant. Munster Paper Sacks, part of CB, and what else was I responsible for? I can't remember. Bits and pieces.
You were a busy man.
Well, yeah, pretty busy.
Yeah. I'm very interested in what happened at the end. You see, you say the government bought...
They bought it for a pound, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
yeah. But,
and so why... I know the reason why, but
yeah.
Why did they sell it then so quickly again?
The government?
Yes.
The government don't want to pay for Mill Morris. They want to pay for bail before an election. They don't want it after the election. What the hell is the use of it after the election? They didn't want the paper mill any more than the dog on the street wanted it. But they were obliged because of the number of votes involved. Afraid of their lives.
But the local people kind of wanted to keep it open themselves.
Of course they did. Morris, you've no idea of the scale of money required. You've no idea what it costs to run.
But look what happened. I mean, they sat in... And then everything was sold off for nothing. Nobody even knows.
But Morris, who wants the stuff? It's all out of date. I mean,
there was a lot of good stuff there.
Now. Okay. Well, yeah. That's yeah. all right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's true. I mean, in Bain Gibson is closed now.
Oh, but there was. But then what happened to the Canadians came in and bought?
Yeah, I can't remember now.
And then they sold it very fast.
And then they sold, yeah, because it required it required 100 million at that time. And now you can work out what that means now.
Yes. Yeah.
So there was no way. And yeah. the sheer demands on pollution would close the mill now.
Yeah.
I mean, they were.
I know,
they,
yes.
They were poisoning the river. Yeah, what's the river called?
It was all different colours. Yeah.
There was nothing alive in the bloody river at all.
Yeah.
It's terrible stuff.
Yeah. And then the selling off of the buildings. Like it was
the buildings then. Yeah. Well, funnily enough, the last time I actually drove up there, up past that road, past Dunn Stores, CB packaging sign, is it still up there? Is it
still
there?
Yeah.
That was very good company.
Yeah.
CB. They're making sacks still, I think, up the north.
But tell me, Tom, how, you witnessed the time, like the 60s, the 70s,
yeah,
the 80s.
Yeah, very difficult.
So was Ireland, was it a good place to be at the time, or was there just so much going on in the line of change?
Yeah, there would have been a buzz I went to England like everybody did. There were 70,000 emigrating per week, was it? Or per year? No, per week, must have been, in the 50s. Yeah. And I wasn't exactly part of that. I had met my beautiful, beautiful wife, who's just recently died, in the 1950s, and she was a flyer. She'd been in Tunisia and Strasbourg and Paris and London, and was on the way to New York when she met me. And
what was your wife's name?
Eileen. Gogan, actually.
Gogan? Oh,
yes.
Right. That's an interesting name.
Yes, it is, because her family were all in the bloody movement. Her grandfather had been in the British Army and came back having saved all his money, opened sweet factories. There was a thing called the Gogan Bon Bon, sweet factories and shops all over Dublin, and gave it all to the rising or the movement or the whatever, politically. And eventually they wouldn't even give him a pension. That was old Grandpa Gogan, but anyway. Yeah, the Gogans, and Liam Gogan is, if you've got Irish scholars in your family, Liam Gogan was curator of the museum.
Across the way.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, you'll have to check all this.
Okay.
Liam Gogan closed the gates in 1916 and said, "These gates will never open until Ireland is free."
And that was your wife's
father? That was my wife's uncle.
Uncle,
yeah,
oh yes.
Yeah, yeah. And they married Cork people.
Yes.
And yeah, they were quite a famous family. Sean O'Casey went into the shop in Parnell Street and asked permission to use the name Gogan in the Plough and the Stars. Ginny Gogan is called after the Gogan.
That's right. Yes.
Because out of the GPO, she'd have sandwiches ready for the guys who were trying to get out. And they passed through the shop. She'd give them the sandwiches, and off they went wherever the hell they went. You know, so they're very famous. Well, to me, they're very famous. Larry Gogan is a cousin. One of them, but he's in a different branch.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated with them. They had great stories. Some would talk about it, some wouldn't. You know, they had hard experiences. But anyway, Grandad, a guy I call Grandad, was Eileen's dad, Stephen Gogan, and he was an artist. And he went to the College of Art here, wherever it is. And so it was very fascinating. So I went over to London after her, essentially. And we stayed there. We got married, stayed there for 5 years, and then came back. Now, I came back because things had started to move, I thought. Well, actually, I came back because Grandad got a heart attack. But anyway, I was happy enough to come back because people had been telling me, you know, things are changing. La Masse is beginning to change things, and Whittaker was there, and they had a plan and all the rest of it. So we decided to come home. Really, we came home to see Grandad. We were going to go to France and live in France, and then we were going to go to Spain and live in Spain and all this sort of stuff. But anyway, we came home. And I went into Bailey Gibson.
Okay, and you went right to the top so quickly.
No, stop. No, wait now.
But
it actually was by accident.
Well, you better tell me.
Bailey Gibson was in such a desperate state. My first set of accounts, I came in with 110,000 loss. Now, you've no idea what that kind of a loss is in those days. I mean, it was huge.
Yeah.
So anyway, the financial director said, "At the time, you've made a mistake." I said, "Yes, I've made loads of mistakes because it was my first time around it." You know, so I went back and started again. Of course, it came out at 120,000 loss. But I believed in writing off. If this thing has no value, write it off. But they didn't believe in that. So anyway, eventually he took the books, and I don't know what he did with them, but I said to Eileen when I came home, "I'm not going to stay here more than 3 months." Now, it turned out I was there for 30 years. But all that whole management crowd had to go. I mean, they were incompetent, and if Bailey Gibson were going to survive, they had to go. So they went more or less themselves. You know, they did push off. And so then that cleared the way for me a little bit to become financial controller, and then the guy who came in as general manager had a nervous breakdown, and that cleared the way for me to become general manager and managing director. So I don't know whether it's time, but I did keep it open for the 30 years. And if my only claim is that I kept families alive and educated and clothed for those.
And who were the people that you depended on mostly there?
Oh, well, my great pal.
Sorry, ignore that. Yeah,
my great pal was Alan Field, production director, and Norbert McDermott was financial controller. John Hamilton, who had been in the SAS during the war and was over before D-Day and would never fly in an aeroplane again. Arthur Beattie, who had been managing director of Cherry and Smaldage, became one of my reps. Paul Gaskin, Angus Edge, all the gang, do you know?
Okay, yes. But you were... You worked as a team, did you?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't bad at that. I claim that I'm pretty good at getting people together and motivating them, and if you stopping the nonsense. I used to say to them, "No chat in the corridor. If you want to chat, you chat in my office.
Yes.
You work
yes.
outside of that. If you've got a problem, come in to me. We'd sort it out, and then we work.
Okay.
We don't no politics in the corridor. That was and think out a policy. Didn't matter whether it was intelligent or unintelligent or stupid, but think out a policy, tell everybody what the policy is, keep communicating it, and tell them this is what we're going to do.
Yes.
And then men somehow are very simple-minded. If you give them that clarity, they'll get after it.
Of course, yeah. Yes.
Don't leave confusion. No confusion. We know exactly what we're trying to do. And we were reasonably successful.
Yes, and the group then...
The group went very well. The group expanded, Henry expanded in England. The UK, we concentrated in the UK first, and we had companies, I think somewhere in you see it in the annual report, somewhere in Nottingham or Lincoln or up there, and we had companies... And there was several of them, but he saw that there was... He was very clever. Henry was very clever. Is very clever. He would very quickly see, although his background wasn't packaging, he would see which of the areas were profitable and what we used to call sticky labels, self-adhesive labels. You know, you see them everywhere. He saw that that was great potential profitability and various things like that. And then, he had this long experience in Holland and had a European connection to his dad. He started to look at Europe. Now, I didn't do anything with him in Europe. I did England with him. I did the States, and he actually, again, you can't put any...
Yes.
He actually wanted me to go to the States to head up everything in the States, and I had no interest.
Well, why not?
America never attracted me.
Isn't that interesting you should say that?
Yeah.
And is it because of the attitude of the people?
I don't know. It is just, too brash, too... I don't know, they just drove me bats. I was in New York 5, 6, 7 times. They were very kind to me. We did a lot of big business with Avon Cosmetics.
Yeah.
They had a factory down in Port Leash, and we got all the packaging, which I negotiated on Fifth Avenue with a great guy. And that night he flew me to Buffalo, and I met another fellow called Tommy Hogan. He brought me all the way to meet Tommy Hogan, and the two of us looked at each other. And the following morning they gave me a book called The Quest for the Galloping Hogan. So they were great in that sense, but they just—it wasn't for me.
Okay. You were looking at the other side.
But really, at this stage, I was getting browned off.
Yeah, and so were there any other Irish companies that you felt like taking in?
No, there was very little left. I mean, between Smurfit and Clondalkin, a lot of them. There were other companies. Dakota was there and others, but they were private.
Yeah.
They weren't available.
And what about this man in Cork?
Guy and Company. Yeah,
yes.
They were great. They were terrific.
What kind of man was he?
There were two of them. There was John and Jerry Guy. Now, their dad would have started a man I did not know. They went to St. Columbus up in Rathfarnham, near Marley Park. And they were country gentlemen. They were two brothers. They were real country gentlemen. If you rang at certain times of the year, you were just told Mr. John was not available. Now, you knew he was out shooting. He was shooting, or he was... Well, they didn't hunt on horseback, but they would shooting or fishing or sailing. Jerry had been in the British Merchant Navy, the other brother, and so they were... But they ran a very tight ship and a very successful ship and a very efficient ship. They were very, very good. A shop in Patrick Street.
Yeah.
Now, that's all gone. But guys are still there and still making very good money. Now, what happened was that, but they were of a different generation. Things had to change, and people don't like change.
Yes.
So fellas like me coming down from Dublin were resented bitterly. I mean, who are you? We've been doing it this way. We're quite successful. You know, that kind of thing. So there were always sensitivities. I'm sure there still are, but there were sensitivities. So eventually, John got cancer and died very young. Lovely guy, absolutely terrific guy. Mad about John. Jerry was on the board of Clondalkin. He and I joined from Gibson Guy, if you like. And he lived to be quite an age. But another chap called Billy McMullen went down from Dublin as the managing director and was extremely successful and turned Guy's into a very, very successful company, which is, I'm sure it's still thriving. So they sold Patrick Street and they bought different factories. They were in paper merchanting as well and all sorts of things. But they're very successful.
Another link with the group. Very important one.
The Smaldridge bit of the Gibson Guy in Smaldridge was a disaster down in the Five Lamps. I think one of my first jobs was I was told to go down and close it. and that was gone. And then they owned a company called Irish Art, which was down in Abbey Street, and that was a disaster. They weren't great. The Gibson guy and Smaldridge management weren't exactly great, now, I have to say.
And Smaldridge, who were they?
Sam Smaldridge was a Protestant gentleman, no interest in the business, none whatsoever. Nice chap, but... you see, at one stage it was easy to open a company and get going, but like when the crunch came, they didn't know what to do. These men didn't, they'd never experienced aggressive selling.
Yes.
I mean, Michael Smurf was a totally foreign animal to them.
Yeah.
But
he was an entrepreneur.
He was great. Smurf would come into my office one day in Bailey Gibson. I was the financial controller, and I'm telling you, I mean, I can remember him standing there, and he said, "I want you." I said, "Oh." He said, "What are you wearing?" I said, $2,400. Put your salary under $3,000. Now it's huge. In the 1960s, that was big money.
Yes.
You know, I know it sounds terribly Mickey Mouse now, you won't get a holiday for it, but in those days, that was. I didn't see anything. I couldn't just take out the book and change my salary, and no authority to do it whatsoever. That's the kind of man he was, you know? Because he was so convinced he was going to get it. And then he said to me, "You're going to become my PA. We'll travel everywhere together, blah, 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 blah," all this stuff. And I went down to Sydney and told him all this. Poor old Sydney. Sydney, no idea how to deal with this kind of thing.
Yes.
And then Smurf would come into the yard in a 3.5 Rover, and he'd pile Sydney into the back and me with him, and he'd drive around all his plants. And this was all very strange, very pressurized. Frankly, I was delighted with it. It was new. This man was going to change things.
Okay.
Now, you had to be very careful of him, too.
Yes.
Very careful. And I could tell you some very funny stories about guys who got close to him, you know, too close. But, I mean, at the same time, a lot of them became very wealthy with him and all the
of
rest.
Course,
you know, yeah. And I knew them all. You know,
but he was a man that you didn't want him on your wrong side, on the wrong side.
No, that'd be a bit like marking Paddy O'Shea. Oh no, you didn't want him on the wrong side. No, what was the famous guy who played corner forward for Dublin, and Paddy was right corner back? Our big guy, and we thought he would take Paddy, and I don't think he didn't get a score. Joe. I can't remember his name. No, his name will come back to me.